Welcome to Public Live, your real-time resource for educational information about market trends, economic news, and publicly traded companies. Public Live is designed to broaden your knowledge as an investor. These sessions are not direct investment advice, so listen in, but always do your own research. See public.com/disclosures for more information. With that, let's get things started. Take it away, hosts.
Hello, 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 everybody, and welcome once again to Public Live. We have a fantastic show lined up for you today. I am so excited to dive in. So let's get going with just that. Today, we are exploring space, or more specifically, exploring the space economy and where it's headed. This is the first show in a new monthly series presented by Terran Orbital. That is the ticker LLAP. It's a manufacturer of small satellites. And this is our first show, but we're going big and we're going to dive into the outlook for the space industry over the next several years. We're joined by two extremely knowledgeable experts in this field from McKinsey's Aerospace and Defense Analytics team. I'm so thrilled to welcome my guests today, Chris Danick and Jess Harrington. Chris, Jess, how's it going?
Very good. Great to be here.
Awesome.
Going great.
Good, good. I'm so glad to have you guys here today. We have a ton of really exciting conversation ahead of us. But before we dive into all of the big stuff, I would love if you could just introduce yourself really briefly. Let us know who you are and what you do. Jess, you want to kick us off?
Sure. I'm Jess Harrington. I lead our defense vertical inside of Radar, which is McKinsey's aerospace and defense analytics platform. I spend a lot of time researching and serving clients on space topics. I spend most of my time looking at national security and defense space, but I do have exposure to all sorts of space topics.
So cool. And Chris, how about you?
Sure. Yes. So I lead the overall Radar team, which includes commercial aviation and space, as well as defense. As Jess said, space crosses a lot of different areas, though. My personal background helped found the company that became this platform within McKinsey. And before that, had a career in the Air Force where I did a bunch of space-related topics.
Well, incredible. And I think that we have two great guests here today to walk us through some really big concepts. And I'm really excited to get started. So I think with that, are you guys ready to jump in?
Absolutely.
All right. So let's do it. So let's think about, you know, over the last few years, I think anybody who's listening to this has probably seen that there has been just an uptick in the amount that we talk about space-related companies. Also, with those space-related companies, we've seen an increase in the number that are raising money, the number that are going public, the number that are kind of breaking through into the mainstream in terms of business and finance news. So I want to know, what will it take to win in that pretty competitive environment? You know, obviously the goals are very ambitious, very future oriented for a lot of these space companies. So I'm curious about what might set some of these companies apart as compared to the rest of the competitive field. You know, what is unique about how these companies might maybe balance their short-term profits and their, you know, viability in the short term with more ambitious long-term kind of goals?
I'm happy to answer this one. So I think that we've seen an uptick in just money and capital flowing into more advanced technology industries in general, but space has definitely generated a lot of excitement. You have a lot of really talented people with a lot of really wildly innovative ideas and capabilities who are really speeding to get out advanced technologies up into space. I think that with this real excitement around these advanced technologies, we've seen a lot of new players emerge, a lot of players who are really excited about being the person to provide these space products. The things that are going to differentiate these types of players are kind of span a couple of different categories. I think one is, in some cases, a first mover advantage is really going to help. If there are a lot of different companies who are providing the same type of capability, so if this is something like remote sensing, being the first one with the contract is going to help you stay afloat. You know, that capital is really important. I think the other thing is any sort of technical edge. If you can move quicker than your competitors, that's going to keep you in a good space for longer. I think one thing to really keep in mind when we're thinking about space companies is that investors really have to have some patience. As with any kind of advanced technology company, the returns are going to be a little bit further out than they would be on something with a really clear near-term payoff. I would really look at companies that have connected with a near-term market need as probably the most competitive here, but without sacrificing that kind of lofty long-term advanced technology goal.
Absolutely. And you bring up an important idea here, the presence of retail investors now investing in the space industry. For so long, it felt like investing in space was not necessarily an option for a lot of retail investors. Over the last decade or so, we've really seen that shift. So with retail investors perhaps looking to company leadership, I think is a big part of maybe their investment decision making. Being, you know, obviously cognizant of what you mentioned, that the returns are going to be further out. You have to be prepared for that. But when it comes to trying to invest in some of these leaders who have really emerged in the space industry as pretty well-known types of leaders, what kind of leadership traits specifically do you think are crucial at the CEO level in this industry?
Well, I'll try that one. I don't think there's a recipe. But I think there are a couple of things that are important. One is you certainly want somebody with a vision. These are long-term goals. You want somebody who can inspire the company, inspire the investors. You also need somebody who's got a very hard-edged practicality about them. To echo something just said, you need to, as much as possible, ground what you're doing in near-term opportunities. If you say the payoff is 10 years down the road, not many people will hang with you for that journey. If you start seeing traction earlier, that'll be good. So it's a combination of the visionary leadership, very practical business sense, or the, you know, within the team, having the ability to to have that practical business sense of how do you actually get to revenue. So I think those are two of the major pieces. What I wouldn't necessarily say is important is the technical background. A lot of people you see in the space business are space geeks. You know, there are people like me who grew up in the, you know, in looking at the industry. I'm an engineer. You know, they like making better toys. And if you're following a field of dreams strategy, saying, well, we're surely somebody will buy this, then that's a bit of a risk. You want the people who are actually grounded in the market.
Yeah, I like the idea of the practical visionary. I think that's a really interesting characteristic to identify. And I appreciate the field of dreams inclusion there. You know, if you build it, they will come does not always stand up, especially with something as technical as what we're talking about here, which I think gives us a great opportunity to dig into some of the components, technologically speaking, of the space economy. And I would love to start with satellite tech. I think this is super interesting. And I would love to hear from you guys what some of the biggest use cases are for satellite tech, particularly the ones that the average person like me, maybe just a casual space kind of follower here, what an average person might not even have on their radar in terms of satellite tech. What's interesting to you? What are you keeping up with right now?
So it's an interesting question because a lot of times the most critical enabling things are not necessarily, they don't necessarily have an immediate payoff. I'll use a couple of things that are important for the current industry, which are laser inter-satellite links and phased array antennas, flat panel antennas, which would let you communicate with multiple satellites or satellites in different orbits at once. Those things perhaps are not the technology that's most relevant to people on Earth. If you want to flip it around the other way, sometimes the applications of these things are not immediately obvious. Think about GPS. GPS is so heavily embedded in everything we do that we're not even aware of it. In your map app on the phone, in timing for bank transactions, and all sorts of other things. So in many cases, the technology that is created through these space systems will have applications that aren't even foreseen yet. that's one of the exciting things about the new generation of satellite internet. I'm not sure that even the visionaries have fully thought about the different ways that might be applied if it comes into full fruition.
Yeah, super interesting to imagine what the application of this technology might look like in the future. You know, obviously we have our ideas of what the future could look like, but I'm curious to understand a little bit better how that tech might be applied here on Earth, perhaps in a shorter time span. Your recent report, Outer Space in 2030, which, you know, checks notes is less than a decade away, predicts that we could see a significant proliferation in the number of satellites in space over the next few years. But how might that change or improve or really impact at all life here on Earth? You know, as new challenges arise, talking about space junk and you know, concepts such as that, how are we here on Earth going to utilize that tech and deal with the ways that that tech might change our way of life?
I'm happy to take the first pass at this, and I'm sure Chris has some thoughts. But the important thing to think about is that we have way more satellites going up now than we did even 5 years ago, just in terms of the sheer numbers being launched. They're being launched for a variety of different purposes. You have constellations, and a constellation is just really a group of satellites all kind of working towards the same goal. But you have these constellations going up for communications. And what we mean by that is things like satellite internet. So the thing that you would see as an impact on Earth is maybe my plane internet's a little bit better, or maybe in a place where, you know, I don't have really great internet options right now, I can get my internet from a satellite that's, you know, drifting by my house. I think there's also applications for weather. We've seen remote sensing constellations going up as well. So this is, you know, something that's going to be taking pictures of the Earth. And as Chris said, there are applications that come from this. So it's not just taking the picture of the Earth and that being kind of the product, but what is the analysis that comes out of that? What is the app that comes out of taking a picture of the Earth? Maybe this is allowing me, if I'm a farmer, to track my cows a little bit better. Right. I don't know, Chris, if you have anything you want to add to that.
I'd add a couple of things. So Jess mentioned the remote sensing. Better weather prediction is one of those things. If you're concerned about severe weather events, the ability to have a finer resolution, tracking of storms, things like that, this could provide some warning, improve safety, perhaps help us manage risk. Other environmental monitoring, the ability to cover the entire planet from orbit will let us do a good mapping of changes in the atmosphere, of changes in, you know, if you're thinking about monitoring emissions of different kinds, that's a possibility. The satellite, again, connectivity anywhere. One of the things that certainly came up during COVID is both the necessity of being connected when you're in a remote location in some cases, and also the desirability, you know, so that you don't necessarily have to work from one place. You can be location independent. Those are the kinds of things that these, you know, these newer generations of satellite technology are likely to enable.
So that's quite the list of use cases, and certainly some that are new to me. So I appreciate the breadth of that list. But from what I understand, with all of these satellites being launched into space, Jesse mentioned that there are way more now than there were just a handful of years ago. Is the concept of space junk a concern for people in your industry? Can you explain a little bit more what space junk is? And of course, let me know if there are any specific players or any specific incentives or strategies in the industry in tech space with how to deal with this potential rise in space debris.
I'll go ahead and start, just pile on, please. So, yes, there will be orders of magnitude more satellites launched in coming years than what people are accustomed to. So as many as, you know, 10,000 a year potentially coming up. And it could get even higher. There are big questions about what one of the terms that you hear now in the industry is, what's the carrying capacity of a specific orbit? Can the orbits get overcrowded? So one concern for industry This is, will you have interference either electronically in terms of spectrum management or physically in terms of potential collisions? And so it's going to take some cooperation amongst the players, because there really isn't any overarching way to control this. There's going to have to be some cooperation in managing this. One of the, I think, key principles for the entire industry is to try not to make the problems any worse than they already are. Nobody really knows how many pieces of tiny debris there are, hundreds of thousands. There's about 30 or 40,000 that we can track. Those all are potential collision risks. So there is some concern about the viability of the space environment long term. At some point, we probably will have to look at some ways of actively cleaning up orbits, because many of these pieces of debris will be in orbit for decades or centuries. But that requires some technological solutions that don't really exist yet. We can do bigger pieces, and I think you've started to see some experimentation with grappling with things on orbit and bringing them back into the atmosphere.
You mentioned the tech solutions that are needed to solve this problem don't exist yet. Are there entities that are working on those solutions?
They're experimental efforts. You have the space agencies in Europe and the U.S. and other places who are funding experiments. There are a variety of concepts out there. People have talked about everything from using lasers to slow down the debris so it orbits naturally, to space nets. Some people have even proposed having harpoons or other things to grapple with larger chunks of debris. But it's all very much in the experimental phase. The things that are closest to reality are the ones that can dock with larger objects, dead satellites or rocket bodies or something. And removing them would be a step forward. But again, there's also the question of who's going to pay for that.
Yeah, I can't imagine that it's particularly cheap to build a space-faring harpoon. So I guess we'll just have to check back on that one in a couple of years and see where we are with even more satellites going up in the coming years, I imagine. So I'd like now to shift to the applications of space tech in national security and defense specifically. I want to understand a little bit better how governments are currently leveraging space tech. And with that, do you see that those applications of space tech from governmental entities changing in the future at all?
I think that it's important to have the historical context here, where the government, in particular the Department of Defense, but also NASA, and for other countries, their civil and military space agencies, it's been kind of an integral part of government for decades. And in fact, it's only recently that commercial has kind of started to emerge as a really big market for space players here. So I think the one real shift that we've seen is this kind of, well, and especially this is really focused on the US, but this kind of focus on less traditional vendors providing space capabilities. So what you used to have is pretty much every defense company had some sort of focus on space. This was really big space satellites or rockets that cost a lot of money to build. They were handmade. And now what you're seeing is a little bit more of these kind of scrappy commercial players who can make things more cheaply and make things faster. And in some cases, the actual way that the Department of Defense or NASA is buying these things is different. They're exploring subscription models. They're exploring abilities, kind of a leasing model, in addition to actually buying and operating the technology, which they've always done. There's some real examples of this. The Department of Defense has been exploring doing some experiments with satellite internet. This is public. The NRO has, renewed their remote sensing contracts. These are kind of ways that are still fairly new that the government is exploring, kind of working with public sector, with the private sector on how to do business.
Yeah, and we've seen a lot more of these public-private partnerships be big news over the last couple of years, especially. But I have, from what I understand, have come to know that the ways that the public sector versus the private sector go about doing business can be very different. So I'm curious about the dynamic shifts within these burgeoning relationships between public and private entities. What do those partnerships look like? And I know, Jess, you mentioned that there are subscription and leasing models that are becoming more popular, but does the way that government entities versus private companies go about work impact their relationships at all?
I think it certainly does. The government has talked for a long time about spinoff of defense technologies or other scientific research to commercial sector and vice versa spin on. The changes in the past few years, in my opinion, they're putting a little bit more money now behind that. There's something called the Space Enterprise Consortium, which is a group of companies. It's over 300 now. And they funneled well over $1 billion into that consortium to do various things in a non-traditional way. So there's real money now finally being spent on this. As far as the relationships go, it remains a challenge. The government is used to buying things a certain way. Buying commercial products is always a bit difficult. But I do think there's been some progress.
All right. Now, I want to pivot to one other big topic here before I let you guys go. Let's talk about space tourism. This is obviously very interesting, gotten a ton of buzz over the last couple of years, I would argue in large part due to the high profile nature of a lot of the leadership involved. We're talking about Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin, Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic, like insert billionaire here. They probably have some sort of space effort going on that might include space tourism. So with that in mind, how far are we from democratizing space tourism, if this is something that can be democratized?
So I know Justin and I talked about this quite a bit. What you have now to some extent is a really expensive roller coaster ride. And so this is definitely not for every person. And personally, I don't think that you're going to get to the point where it's like your $59 weekend fare to go to the beach on an airline. So it depends what you mean by democratization. Certainly, as the opportunities proliferate, the technology gets better, it'll be accessible to a greater segment of the population. But this, in my mind, really falls into the adventure tourism, the experience type of thing that you do relatively few times in your life.
Yeah, I cannot imagine that it would be as simple as, like hopping the ferry for the weekend. When we think about the actual use cases, though, for regular civilian use of space travel, beyond just the idea of the really expensive roller coaster ride, the personal enjoyment, the thrill seeking stuff, what are the other use cases? And do you think that we misunderstand some of the use cases for civilian space travel?
It's an interesting question. I mean, there are concepts for doing point to point, surface to surface transport with effectively rocket ships that you can almost see as an extension of supersonic to hypersonic to suborbital. So for those things that absolutely positively have to get somewhere on the surface of the Earth in an hour, you could see some application for that if you're talking about transportation. It's likely to always be a bit of a niche. Again, when speed really matters, the price becomes less important. But this type of transport is very energy intensive. It's not insignificant, although it may not be as much as you think. For example, a Falcon 9 rocket uses about the same amount of fuel as a 777 for a long range flight. So it's not a huge difference, but it also doesn't carry nearly as many passengers. So again, the price is going to be higher.
Wow, that's interesting. I never knew that about the fuel usage. Certainly a tidbit that I will carry into my conversations about this in the future, because this is something that I think has come up in conversation, I'm sure, for a lot of people who are listening to this as well. The idea of what the future might look like. We always have these grandiose ideas of what, you know, the Jetsons future might become, but it's really interesting to consider what that might actually look like in practice, right? Going from the theory to the actual practice, the implementation of this technology, certainly incredibly interesting. So my final question, you guys are obviously both very deep within this area. And so I'm curious to know, what is something about the space economy that has surprised you, or maybe something that you think the average person who might be listening to this would be most surprised to learn?
I can go first. I am just consistently amazed by all the like weird and cool use cases for space. Maybe not quite, you know, revenue producing businesses at this time, or at least not, you know, not going to make you a billionaire. But things like you can get your ashes scattered in space if you want to. That's a service that's been offered for a while. You can have, there are people talking about having weddings in space, going up in a capsule, and you can buy the capsule and have your wedding with the view of space in the background. You know, the idea that someday there might be a space hotel and you could go do a moonwalk and, you know, hang out in space, like just totally wild advertising happening in space, people shooting movies in space. It just is really cool to me that there's this many different kinds of things that space is being used for.
Yeah, so interesting. Chris, anything to add there?
Nothing that can really top the idea of, you know, wedding to funeral in space. But I will say that it's consistently impressed me in the last few years how much of an upsurge of interest there is. There is real momentum here. You know, the space world is qualitatively different than in the Apollo era, when it was really just a competition between governments. You do have a lot of entrepreneurship. You have a lot of excitement about it. I think that it's hard at this point to say exactly where it's going to go, but given human nature and creativity, I think what we will see is, you know, some unexpected things come out of here. So it's really exciting to see all the ferment.
Absolutely. And I am excited to watch all of this unfold over the next decade plus. By the time we get to 2030, I imagine that this conversation will be incredibly different, with a ton of new questions, new ideas to explore. But for that, we will come back to you guys. And today we will leave it just at these questions. Chris, Jess, thank you so, so much for joining me today on Public Live. I really appreciate your time and all of your insight. This was wonderful.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. And thank you so much to everybody out there for listening as well. I hope you learned as much as I did, certainly walking away with some very interesting tidbits that, like I mentioned before, I will be finding a way to weave into every conversation that I have for the next several days, I imagine. With that, I will say goodbye. Thank you all for listening. Have a fantastic rest of your Wednesday.
Thank you.